nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
This is a NAC webinar. It's put on by the Nanotechnology Applications and Career Knowledge, or NAC, Resource Center, which is an NSF ATE regional center for nano manufacturing education. We are a part of the CNEU, or Center for Nanotechnology Education Utilization. We're located here in Penn State, College of Engineering Department within Engineering Science and Mechanics. We're actually located at all different places right now across the country. We're also, this is co-hosted by the MNTEC, or the Micro Nanotech Education Center, which is the new national center, it's a couple years old now. The idea of working together to accomplish a greater goal will enhance the quality of education for our students and then become a higher quality for technicians in industry. Our main goal is to bring technicians to industry, train them and bring them to industry in the MNT workforce. Our hosts and presenters are, I'm the play-by-play commentator, and we've got a couple of color commentators, if you will. My name is Bob Ehrman. I'm with the NAC Center at Penn State, the aforementioned NAC Center. Zach Gray is the managing director at the NAC Center. And then Dr. Kendrick Davis is actually the co-PI of the MNT Kern, which is undergraduate research project. He's out of Pasadena City College, so he's in Los Angeles, California, or Pasadena, wherever right now. Zach is in Pennsylvania. I happen to be in New Jersey, and then I'm going to introduce Dr. Belinda Kennedy. Belinda Scarborough Kennedy. She's with IBM University Special Programs Manager. She and her team work on higher education leadership worldwide in medical institutions and HBCUs, or historic Black colleges and universities, providing access to industry resources to bridge the gap between academic programs and high demand career skills. The team works with medical, nursing, life sciences, pharmaceutical institutions, HBCUs, to provide faculty and students industry experiences using IBM's academic program for no charge access to resources. She's going to be exploring this a lot during this presentation. The goal is to build critical skills with artificial intelligence, quantum computing, Internet of Things, data science, design thinking, cybersecurity, blockchain, and other hot technology areas, through engagement with academic, government, industry leaders to augment education to include accelerated use of advanced technology into most disciplines. Quite the list. Now in her 34th year at IBM, Belinda has held a variety of engineering, sales, service, and executive management positions. These assignments include HBU strategist, Global University's academic initiative high-touch program manager, management of sales specialist, technical architects and business development executives, financial services, and a client unit director, ecosystems development manager, market segmentation and development leader, technical sales and support specialist and manager, services business development executive, disaster recovery specialist, systems engineer. That's an awesome resume, Belinda. Degrees include a bachelor of degree in applied mathematics and an associate degree in computer science at West Virginia State University in 1987 and 1988. We actually had some discussions that I actually spent time in West Virginia and was there at the same time. Activities include being a trustee, senior usher, a choir member at the Logan Street Baptist Church, Monday Night Ladies Bowling Team captain. They don't just give that away. And on advisory boards of West Virginia State University, Bluefield State College, and the University of Illinois Chicago. University of Illinois Chicago Equity and Inclusion Engineering Program. Belinda is an ongoing mentor to veterans with American Corporate Partners and holds an appointment on Indiana Governor Holcomb's Cybersecurity Executive Council. And you are located right now today, Belinda, right now in
I am in the suburbs of Chicago, the home of Batavia, Illinois, Fermilab National Science Laboratory.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Thank you so much, Bob. And thank you for everyone joining us for this discussion today. I really appreciate you taking time out of your very busy day, because all of us have days that just seem to be excessive beyond what we were doing in any prior years in our profession. But that gives a testament to the fact that you've taken time out of your day to spend time with us.
Hey, Valinda, can I break in for one moment?
Absolutely.
I did not give our co-host any time to say anything. I just jumped right over them, and I want them to get their voices in the room, especially these wonderful voices of these co-hosts here, the color commentators. Do you mind letting them come in for a second?
Absolutely.
All right. Dr. Davis?
Hi. Good morning, everyone, or wherever you are, and morning, afternoon. I'm Kendrick Davis. As Bob said, co-PI of the MNT undergraduate research program. Out of the M&T Center at Pasadena City College, but also on the faculty at the USC Rosser School of Education and Chief of Research at the USC Race and Equity Center. I'm just excited to be here. I think it's a really timely and important discussion, and glad to be continuing our partnership in this way.
Thanks. Thanks, Kendrick. I appreciate it. And Dr. Gray.
Hello, everybody. My name is Zachary Gray. I'm, as you can see from the background, I'm from Penn State University, along with Renee and Bob. Essentially, Bob Ehrman he's retired, well-deserved, and I'm filling in, taking over a lot of his role. And I'm involved pretty heavily with teaching our nanofabrication course to 2- and 4-year students here at Penn State. And I look forward to hearing this webinar today, and I'm really glad we got this set up.
Thanks. Thanks, Zach. I appreciate it. Valinda, I'm going to turn it back to you. I apologize for the interrupt, but you said you didn't mind being interrupted. So that was our first interruption.
Absolutely. Welcome interruptions. So thank you very much for making sure everyone knows who all the players are this morning, Bob. And right before we started those additional introductions, I started my very first page, and you saw it just, you know, get swamped with headlines, headlines across the globe around the topic we're going to cover today. And this is a global problem. So it's not like, well, we don't have enough of these resources in the U.S. We'll just go get them from another country. Other countries are running into the exact same challenges. And this is not a month-long problem. This is not a couple weeks. This is for the projected future. We recognize this is an ongoing problem that globally we have to address. And that's why we're having this dialogue today. As we go through this discussion, we want to talk about how we look at the trillions of dollars of what we're talking about when we really try to understand the scope and impact of what we are globally facing today. We are seeing that we have a challenge, but also the opportunity, because customers are more tech savvy than ever before. We see that social media and mobile technology are driving engagement with consumers and business owners on a much more accelerated timeline than ever seen before in the history of the world. So when we look at this, our technology is way more complex, and people are expecting so much more from it, because what we do in our consumer lives is what we are seeing our clients are demanding in their corporate and business engagement. We have a ton of information that's being underutilized. When we think about the technologies that are in the devices that we have today, we recognize that a small fraction of what we have is really being leveraged to drive better outcomes for all of us. With the globalization problem, we saw firsthand in the last 3 years, how quickly we can go from being a leader into having other competitors quickly come into our space. But we also saw how quickly we could bring a product to market and it be adopted on a global scale. So when we look at this, what could be one organization's challenge is another organization's opportunity. In that opportunity, though, we've seen a lot of businesses come about because of the demand by consumers and governments for greener solutions, more sustainability in whatever companies bring to market, and current established companies being expected to ensure that whatever they deliver to the market, they're doing it in a sustainable way. So we're also seeing power shifts with all of these opportunities, with all of the new business potential that could come up. We are quickly seeing power shifts emerge and advance and take over like never before. And so for us, one of the big changes is non-traditional businesses are increasing competition for those traditional businesses that have been in establishments. The great thing about this is that means everybody has the opportunity to develop new ways of driving revenues. We are partnering, we're seeing partnering with our service channels. And this was something that 10 years ago, it was seen as state of the art. Now it's expected as business as usual. So these new business models give way to new companies, but they also give way to established companies going into new markets with new approaches. Embracement of technology is not an option. It's table stakes today. There is the expectation, just think about the technology within 6 feet of you right now. Most of us have a couple laptops, couple screens, couple phones, printers, and that's just within a 6 foot radius. And we all expect that that technology enables us to be more effective in the work we do day to day. When we branch out beyond that 6 foot radius, and remember, lots of times we don't have to branch out because we use the exact technology that you're using to watch this video as a way for us to conduct business. It was a necessity during the pandemic, and most of us recognize this is not going away. We will adopt some more of our traditional business models, but this way of communicating and delivering transactions and taking information from the technology itself and making recommendations, that's business as usual for us and for our clients. This drives more of a connected ecosystem philosophy, more now than ever before. Think about what happened during the pandemic. There was telemedicine. There was the ability for individuals to monitor their health based on a device that was attached to them or near them without them physically having to see a doctor. These are just a few examples of how the ecosystems have changed. And now there's the expectation that so much more can be done with technology as it's announced. When we talk about that, we're talking about market activation for delivering these experiences to the market because of current consumer and business expectations. Monetizing customer relationships is a big news item. We hear, we see it, we understand that governments are getting involved in this because we recognize the use of the data for profit is becoming more and more commonplace on a global scale. So we have to make sure when this data is used, we avoid bias in how the data is driving business decisions. Think about this from your own standpoint. Most of us would be very concerned if our insurance company had data coming from our refrigerator to see what we ate for breakfast, to see what we ate for lunch, and maybe how late we had our evening snack. Think about this while we can maybe say that in jest. If our insurance companies have that level of data about us and then deny us coverage, that's where we get into this trust and transparency type of issue that makes the public very concerned about how their data is being used. So this situational awareness is really important. It's one thing if you get data from me on my use of my refrigerator to restock it. It's a whole different issue if you use that same data and another company leverages it to deny me services or to promote certain services. This is what's driven us to the need for relentless talent, needing to get talent at all levels of the supply chain process in place so that we have included diversity across it. So we're thinking about these types of discussions so that we continue to have a pipeline of talent coming through our organizations, institutions, and individuals so that we can continue to meet the market needs and develop the market opportunities. This is having our people, and that's a global statement for our people, ready to go, ready to take the opportunity, and not only take that opportunity, but all of us be able to be prepared to move it to the next level. So we talk about this. We recognize in the post-COVID-19 world, we're now in a world where this week, masks became optional in the U.S. We have so many changes that we're now incorporating what happened because of COVID-19. Now, as we recover from it, what are we going to do next? The electronics industry overall financially wasn't as negatively impacted as some other industries, but some of the subsegments of the semiconductor electronics industry had huge impacts because of the interconnectivity of us being able to deliver the chips needed to get various products to market. Now we have, as we expect, a lot of the earnings calls happening last week and this week, and there's a high deal of pressure on cash flow. And how do we ensure that organizations can continue business continuity in face of challenges? Now, I am fortunate to reside in the wonderful suburb of Batavia, Illinois, the home of Fermilab National Science Laboratory. And when we talk about business continuity in the Illinois area, there's one college that has identified they are currently looking at shutting their doors in May because of the effects of COVID and a ransomware attack. Those two occurrences were more than they could recover from. So we think about the challenges post-COVID-19, accessibility because of COVID-19 restrictions, recoverability because of ransomware attacks, being able to manage against new competition. These are all things that businesses are facing today. And new competitions can be that traditional competitor just down the street. It can be global competitors because people can now go online and have products shipped, as we all know, directly to our door. But we also want to make sure when we look at this, we see the new competitors that are coming into place. And this is really tough for semiconductor companies as we race to embrace digital technologies, but it's being done at a slower pace that some other industries were forced to do because of the global issues over the last 2 years. Supply chains were heavily impacted because of COVID-19. They continue to be impacted because of the war going on now in the Ukraine. There's discussion when you get on earnings calls last week and this week about because of companies pulling out of the Ukraine, what's that has meant to the bottom line and the financial results. So that revenue erosion is part of what companies are struggling with now. You see companies talking about, particularly car dealers, as an example. They already had a shortage of cars, and then other items have actually put them in a deeper position of not being able to drive the revenues they would like to drive if only they had the product. Business model relevance. This is important because companies that were once completely B2B companies are looking at how do we potentially expand to do more B2C? How do we directly engage with that consumer? So business models are adapting as changing, as competition is becoming more fierce, as well as the world deals with issues because of COVID-19. And of course, now the big world issue is the war going on in the Ukraine. While doing all this, consumers are expecting it to be done in a sustainable way that we're looking at the overall impact to the world we live in. So the great thing about this is those who are listening to this live or hearing it on a replay, you understand how important this is. The other piece, though, is when we look at this, most all of us can relate because we have a phone. We have members of our family that's using everything you see highlighted here in the red circle. This is what many people around the globe have and depend upon today to do their day-to-day business and even things outside of business. This is how a lot of people go to work. This is how a lot of people get medical advice. This is how a lot of people make sure the right products and services are in the right hands. We are completely seeing a change from the last 100 years. where we didn't have phones to the point where we have phones and we're so heavily dependent upon them. However, there's only a handful of fabrication manufacturers for chips for the rest of the world, and they are completely saturated with demand right now. The challenge we all know this creates is that the downstream manufacturing is dependent upon those semiconductors that are not coming out of the factories just because they are at capacity. This is limited inventory, whether we're talking about car inventory, whether we're talking about MRI equipment, medical equipment, or we're talking about other assets that we are dependent upon. We've seen it when we go to market. We continue to be warned about it from our financial advisors. And you can look at, in the second quarter of 2021, the top 10 semiconductor sales leaders. There's only so much that you can drive through that manufacturing plant floor. We have to have more resources, which includes talent, plants, and the ability to get the product to market. But that means we just need more capabilities to deliver. We have taken on the point of view of, in the U.S., we could do a lot of the advancements with our research. We could make amazing strides and have it actually built somewhere else. This is what got us into a lot of the challenges we have experienced in the last 3 years. So as we think about all the demands that have happened with technology, traditionally, in days of my parents, you bought a car and you kept the car until it no longer ran. You bought a phone, you kept it for your life. Today, we purchased the phone and then we upgraded in 2 years because of additional functionality that we want to use. Additional functionality could be more monitoring of health services. Additional functionality could be more career opportunities. So there's opportunities that come from the explosion, but there's also the recognition that we have to bring to the table. We have to be able to have a really good model in our country in being able to take advantage of this explosion in technology and how we ultimately still can get the end product into the right hands, whether that's the right hands on a consumer perspective or whether it's the right hand on a manufacturing plant floor. We have to have a full life cycle plan to deliver our products to market. So think about it. We've made it almost through the pandemic. And I say almost because we all watch the news. We know we have geopolitical wars going on that are front page news that are impacting the ability for products to get to the end client. When you look at this, automobiles, industrial electronics, communication, the list could go on and on because who's impacted? All of us. At the end of day, when you think about what has happened, we all have a couple stories we could share about the inability to do something because the products were not available for that goal. One example, think about in a car today, how many semiconductors exist in one automobile. This is a conversation that 30 years ago, you had your mechanic, he or she could get in there, solve the problem, give it a good whack with a wrench, and you were off and running. Today, when you take your automobile into service, an analysis is run on it. This is great because it helps them identify the exact source of the problem. Why is that important? Look at the screen. Look at all the different functions that semiconductors help in our vehicles today. And this is today. Think about all the things that are happening with autonomous vehicles, where this chart explodes even further. So when we talk about our semiconductors and the amazing capabilities that are made available to all of us, we also have to recognize we need more long-term plans on how we develop through our research these semiconductor technologies to the next level, but also how we have a manufacturing plan that assures that we can take our knowledge coming from our research, incorporate it into the products we will use today and tomorrow, and get those products into the market without the market piece being the piece that we can't deliver on and receive the benefits, because quite frankly, our go-to-market plan didn't include us going to the market. This is exciting because it means we have a wonderful opportunity to learn the lessons now. Things are taking longer for delivery. Several years ago, the car dealer was having trouble getting people to come into the shop. We had amazing models where people could buy their car online, no discussion, or they could get the used car for their college students. What it means now is we all recognize there are longer delivery times to get many of the products that we took for granted previously. We recognize that smaller brands can't handle that extended delivery timeline. We also recognize in some cases, they just can't handle the shipping fees when products have to sit somewhere because they can't be ultimately delivered to the final destination. Unfortunately, this also means that prices are going up. We see daily how the prices are going up in the U.S. and other countries across the globe, and that's affecting not only the consumers, it's affecting the countries, and it's affecting the ability for the countries to meet consumer demand, which also means it's affecting employability, it's affecting the finances of that country. And if you think about recent reports, we see where places like the Ukraine, who provide a significant amount of wheat for the world, we see this ripple effect of how this is affecting us all. More manufacturing facilities will come to the U.S. India is in the race too, and the U.S. government is recognizing we have to address this problem now instead of getting ourselves in a worse position. When will it end? It will not end. What will happen is we will minimize the problem, hopefully, by intervention with our governments and with industry and with education. When you think about the current problem, we hope it gets better by the end of 2022, when we see more production catching up with demand and we get newer facilities added in. This is really a formula that all countries are looking at because of the explosion of how semiconductors are now critical in so many facets of our lives and the citizenries that they represent. This is exciting, though, because in IBM, we've been doing IBM Global University programs for quite some time. We've had IBM Global University programs like our PhD fellowship program since 1951. We recognize the need to have a constantly changing education model for our clients, and we've incorporated that into the programs we develop to work with our academic partners. Our academic partners are all accredited higher education institutions in the 170 countries that we are allowed to operate in by the U.S. government laws. This is exciting because we didn't just try to come up with a program to work with our academic partners in the last couple of years. It's something we've been able to do and refine over decades. The URL on the page here was one I hope you can capture and go explore on your own. Why would you want to do that? One example of why we do this in IBM, remember I said one example. Don't forget, I said all accredited higher education institutions that are able to, by law in the U.S., have the access to these resources we provided. So whether it's university, community college, technical college, these resources are available to be used by those accredited academic institutions. What you see on my screen here is one example. This is an example around historically Black colleges and universities. Now, historically Black colleges and universities, known as HBCUs, were developed by the Higher Education Act of 1965. I say it was developed then because HBCUs have been in place in the United States since around the time of slavery. They were specifically created in order to help people of color be able to pursue understanding things around agriculture, things around the technology at that time, technical things like tractors. When we see technical, think of technical, but think of it in 1890. These institutions started in that time frame, with many of them being land grant institutions, to train the community. Why was that important? Because there was laws in many states where people of color were not allowed to be taught to read and write. So this is one example of why it is so critical that all groups be represented as we develop these pipelines and roadmaps to take advantage of new technologies and enhanced technologies and leverage all the education resources that are available to us. So as we think about this, I give you an example of the CARES Act and how money was in the CARES Act to help with some of our schools. And there is more detail out there. I put the URL here for you, but this is not just about historically Black colleges and universities.
Can I ask a quick question? I'm sorry.
Yes, please.
Yes. One of the things that you mentioned, you put that URL, you had the URL up. Can you share that one more time and we'll put it in the chat window? Because I missed it there. And I apologize. I was like, oh, I got to write that down. And you moved the slide on me. That was one. And then the second thing, the resources that you have there, are they free? Or is there a cost for these? Or how does that work?
Great question, Bob. Thank you. Because I didn't say the key word, did I?
These resources
in the IBM Globe University programs are no charge because they're specifically designed for accredited academic institutions to use it for teaching, learning, and non-commercial research purposes. So they're free. Great question. So this is just, speaking of Valinda's own voice, let's just not think this is about Valinda and her team. What you see on my screen now is a quote from the CEO of IBM, Arvind Krishna. Learning is a continuous process, not an episodic event. It's a mindset driven by a quest for knowledge and passionate curiosity. So this is why IBM provides these resources at no charge. Industry constantly is changing because that's the only way it can maintain continuing to be in business. Jobs are then being created that require new skills because of those changes. We are a perfect example of that as IBM. But you see this on a global basis, especially in the semiconductor space that we're talking about, and in most industries today who are using those semiconductors to deliver value to their clients. Remember, we started with cars who had no semiconductors. And now look at how many of our car functionality that we looked at on that prior page is absolutely dependent upon a semiconductor, in the case of my car, to keep the wipers on. So when it might start to rain, the wipers start automatically clearing the windshield. It's constantly sitting there waiting for that to happen. I don't cut them on. It's just a function of the automobile I choose to drive. So this is why this is so exciting with our global university programs, because we have a combination of major programs under that URL that you saw on the main page.
And can I ask a question while people are responding to the poll, Valinda?
Yes, Kendrick.
One of the, you've said so many amazing things that I want to circle back to. One of the most recent things you said, particularly around the IBM Global University programs, is the idea of access and really expanding access in a time where, you know, things have gone remote, but sort of in a forced way. And we know that during times when we sort of go through forced developments, things don't sort of develop evenly. And one of the, you mentioned a school in Illinois that because of a combination of COVID and ransomware attacks are shutting down, and we're lucky not to sort of have recovered until 2024. And so I would love to hear you talk a little bit more about, and I'll probably have some follow-up questions on how do we use free resources like this IBM Global University to really make sure that in this interim period, right, where people that were struggling continue to struggle, those who didn't have access continue to have issues of access. How do we leverage tools like these free resources to make sure that in 2024, right? That we're not just accelerating change and growth for those who were already poised to make it through these emergencies anyway, but really bringing up the basement, so to speak.
Very important point, Kendrick. Extremely important. When you think about the fact of what we just saw in the poll, the number of people who didn't know that these types of programs are there, that's one of the most important things we have to do in getting the message out, which is why I covered the historically Black colleges and universities. Everyone here, I think, can help with this messaging. When you look at the poll that's on the screen now, it talks about we only have 17% of our academic audience who was aware that these resources were available at no charge. We really want to ensure that at least 83%, we'd love to flip these numbers, know that these resources are out there. Because what tends to happen is we have students who recognize that there's opportunities in these high demand areas. So whether it's about going to a technical college to learn about working with semiconductors, or whether it's going and getting a degree around cybersecurity or taking certificates online to get badge certificates in areas where it costs the student nothing. We need to educate and do a better job of educating the population about what's available in high demand skill areas, but there's very little cost of entry. We recognize students who see opportunities in some cases go, well, I can't do this because I can't afford the hundreds of thousands of dollars for college. But if we can start them down a path of maybe in high school using some of the resources at no charge in the academic initiative, they might then see the opportunity. I got this threat and intelligence hunting badge, no charge on the IBM website. You know, I see what the job opportunities are in my community. I think I could actually get a certificate from my local community college, or I can get a degree from my local university so I could pursue cybersecurity, so I can pursue work in semiconductors, so I could take advantage of Internet of Things, combining all that together. So getting the word out, so those who are in attendance, those who listen to this replay, getting the word out about that Global University Program site is one way we try to spread the wealth. That's why I put up the historically Black college and university example. Let's make sure that the universities we know leverage this, but also other universities that are in our ecosystem that probably are not aware. Even on this call, we had 83% of the participants not aware that this was available for free.
And that the note on HBCU, if I can ask a follow-up, the note on HBCUs is really interesting because for a number of reasons, but one is, you know, the place I met Bob was at the United States Senate some number of years ago, whatever day he decided to fly it, right? Him and Jared didn't fly it. And we were there talking to, you know, students who were coming to present their scientific research, undergraduate research day, I believe. They're presenting their scientific research to members of Congress and their staff. And although I didn't see the academic research part, the one thing that was clear was, and actually, Bob, I don't think you knew this. I think the meeting before, the day before, so this is during the spring when there's budget season happening in Congress, there's a lot of fly-ins. And so the HBCU advocates came in, and I was almost embarrassed not to, as someone who had a, not had, has a PhD in education at the time, I was also embarrassed to know that out of the 100 plus HBCUs in the country, there are no R1s. There are no HBCUs that have attained the R1, you know, research status in the country. In that, right, in understanding that's a systematic breakdown of funding and not just, you know, individual school decisions. And so King, I would love to hear you talk more about sort of the, you know, the literature always talks about HBCUs are underfunded but overperform, particularly when it comes to STEM talent. What are some of the opportunities that exist to highlight the and amplify the successes of HBCUs that might be relevant to other contexts and schools?
Absolutely. So I could spend all day on just that question. So I'm going to try to keep myself contained. You hit upon something, and so let me cover a data point. in the U.S., there's a wonderful Forbes article that lists HBCUs by the amount they have been underfunded compared to their peers. And it's about $12.6 billion. $12.6 billion. So let me make sure we understand that context. There's 105 HBCUs out of the 4,300 higher education institutions in the U.S. So 105 out of 4,300. Those 105 have been underfunded $12 billion. That's a problem. That's not an accident. That's not a one-time thing. That's a detailed, long-term definition of why I called them out and basically why we have HBCUs specifically earmarked in a lot of the programs where you've seen funding from philanthropic means and from companies and organizations and government institutions so much in the last 3 years. Not because they were like just going to throw money at them, because they're actually fixing a problem that's a $12 billion intentional underfunding in the United States. And so the HBCUs, 105 of them, deliver 27% of the STEAM graduates. So I added the arts piece in there because there's things that we can take advantage of when we talk about these technologies that we want to make sure we adapt to going forward. But think about that. 105 institutions out of 4,300 deliver 27% of the science, technology, engineering, and math students in the U.S. Why is this so important? When we talk about diversity of thought and being able to get new talent and innovation into the market, we've got to take advantage of all the routes to market that exist. And when we have one that is overperforming, even while being underfunded, we want to make sure that we recognize that. We try to address the issue. We try to work together to bring all these programs together to take advantage of the knowledge of all the students and all the faculty. Because remember, if we don't do that as the U.S. in the global where we are, where other countries are taking advantage of all their talent, we then run the risk of losing positioning in key areas that make our country what it is. So this is a case of survival and advancement of our economy, but it also just makes us look at this long and hard. If we get such results, even when organizations have been underfunded, think about the possibilities if they actually got the funds necessary to drive their research operations, their skills engagement with their students, and their engagement with the community. So that is such an area. We as IBM have focused on the Ignite program, and we're supporting that as a way that, in addition to all the things we're talking about here today, let's work on ways we correct this problem going forward, because when we correct it, everybody in the U.S. wins. So, Kendrick, thank you for that question, and you and I absolutely need to talk more after this call.
No, thank you for your answer. And I wanted to clarify, that's 27% of the HBCU, the 105 HBCUs graduate, let's say, 30% of, is that Black STEM graduates or STEM talent overall?
So that's STEM talent. So when you think about at the HBCUs, mm-hmm. we look at the graduates that come out, and I'm very fortunate because I am a graduate of West Virginia State University. The reason I'm a graduate of West Virginia State University is because they made an effort to find me on a mountain in West Virginia. I enjoyed math in high school. I enjoyed English in high school, but a college education was going to be a financial struggle. But they came and found me and gave me a scholarship. So I went from being on a mountain in West Virginia to being able to get that college degree, and I hedged my bets. I majored in math because I like math, but I also did that associate degree in computer science because it's all they had at the time. But I also did the associate degree because I hedged my bets. What if it didn't take off? Well, it's associate degree. It'll be a nice compliment to my math degree, me applying my math skills. It did take off. That's what we want our students to have the opportunities to do today in all of our universities. And our HBCUs need these resources and need the funding because they want to have the opportunity for their students to do things in Internet of Things and cybersecurity and cloud computing and quantum computing. So of the 105 HBCUs out of the 4,300 universities, they graduate 27% of the Black talent in science, technology, engineering, and math. So hopefully that answered your question.
No, it absolutely did. And I promise I'll shut up after I say this. The one of the relevant points associated with that is, although HBCUs, that is often, right, something we pull from the literature, that HBCUs are under-resourced but overperform in producing Black STEM talent. The other thing that's worth noting is that, you know, our college and university system did not always just exclude Black people, but also people of color. And so a lot of international students, particularly international students who wanted to come and study STEM engineering, particularly in graduate programs, could only find space at HBCUs. Right. And so you'll see that an overwhelming number of non-Black international students fill the roles of engineering programs at HBCUs because HBCUs were the only ones who were inclusive of them at the time. I promise I'm done.
I agree with that statement. We've had, I actually had a young lady in one of our calls last week say, and she's from India, and she had to pay for her own college education, and she ended up at an HBCU because she got a good education on what she could afford. And she is ecstatic about it. And she does have a job today as a cloud developer in IBM. So a lot more there. And not to just talk about people of color, but I will also remind us all that we have populations in the U.S. that are people who are not of color, but they're poor. And they are well-equipped by having the opportunity to attend HBCUs because it's more within the price range, but they're getting an education that allows them to move themselves out of poverty. And I give you that example when you think about in the state of West Virginia, which has only a 3% African-American population, and I happen to be from West Virginia. There are two HBCUs there, but most of their students are not people of color. They are people who happen to be in the community who are poor, but this is a thing that can change their life because they can now get this college degree and get those better paying jobs that helps them, their family, and the community. So that's why I say everybody wins when we do the right thing with educating and leveraging all of our education resources. So great conversation. Absolutely. Kendrick, you and I will be talking more.
All right, perfect.
So we have these four programs, the Academic Initiative, the Skills Academy, our University Awards, and our guest lectures. These are things that our schools are taking advantage of. And I encourage everyone on this call to use that URL that was put in the chat and start investigating these programs. Academic Initiative, no charge, cloud access to IBM software resources and courseware. And courseware, there's resources where a student can take an online course and get a badge. There's resources where faculty can take an online course and get a badge. There's the software resources that the schools can use in a research capacity as long as it's non-commercial research. So the only stipulation is the resources cannot be used in production. They have to be used for academic purposes around teaching, learning, and non-commercial research. We also have at the bottom of the page our IBM Skills Academy, which is the follow-on to that first IBM Academic Initiative program. The Skills Academy is a combination of faculty training, hands-on curriculum that IBM has built and maintains, and it's part of a portal. So the student takes the course and it can have the faculty in front of the room. They have the ability to do the courses also in a self-study model. So we have two models for how it's delivered so that high-demand areas like artificial intelligence, data science, cloud computing, design thinking, cybersecurity, how could I forget? These are ways that we help our academic partners bring the content into the classroom, help them keep it current so that the students and the faculty have that advantage of being able to compete in these high demand areas because they now have the training and the certificate. Faculty get an authorization badge to teach. Students get a practitioner badge that they can put on LinkedIn and on their electronic portfolios. And students have came back and shared they were able to differentiate themselves in getting jobs in the market, not just tech jobs. In the last 2 weeks, I've had a university send me a note from a student who said he got a brokerage account firm job in the natural gas space because he had these technical badges. That's the type of impact we're talking. And hopefully, as we get this conversation out into the institutions and your institutional ecosystem partners, we take it even further. And then, of course, in the middle of the page, we have our IBM Academic Awards. I mentioned at the top of the call, we have our PhD Fellowship Awards that we've been doing since 1951. We also added our Master's Fellowship Awards to help underserved populations be able to go after more advanced degrees. And then we have academic awards that we work to deliver with our faculty who've leveraged all these other resources. And we'll talk a little more about university guest lectures in just a minute.
Hey, Belinda, I have a quick question on these resources.
Yes.
So you're mentioning a lot about universities and, you know, different things relating to you know, at the PhD level, et cetera. So what level are these resources taught at? Are these taught at some a level like a high schooler or a 2-year college student could understand? Or is this what level are these taught at? I'm curious.
Excellent question. Thank you. Higher education, college, community college, technical college, university. These are really targeted at higher education. Now, we do have some high schools who leverage it because we have more and more robotics clubs in our high schools. We have more and more of the clubs who are doing things around cybersecurity in the high schools. So we do have some of the high schools leveraging the assets, but the resources are really defined so that it would help our academic partners in higher education. And we have many community colleges who are leveraging it. Okay. And you see some examples on the chart that I have in front of us. So we have 10,000 academic institutions, community colleges, technical colleges, and universities make up that 10,000.
Excellent. Thanks.
Thank you for asking. The academic initiative we talked about. Here's an example of the resources available in one area. So in data science, there's data sets out there. There's not only the data science data sets, there's the software that the students get the hands-on from an industry perspective to use. Things like our IBM SPSS Mottler Premium. Hopefully, when you look at this screen, you see that we have software. Our clients pay millions of dollars for this software. We have data sets, so students get hands-on experience with live data. For those who already have a data science program, we have OpenDS for All to help you expand it even further, which we developed with one of our institutions who partnered with us for this call. We have badges. So we have our data science foundational badge so that students can get that first exposure or maybe that more industry-flavored exposure. Python for data science. Let's start getting more of those technical skills out here. And through the academic initiative data science category, these are some of the resources. And we have multiple categories when you go to that IBM Academic Initiative site. Remember again, all for free. It is an IBM Academic Initiative portal. You get there from that main URL that we had on that first page, and no charge resources, software, access to all that you see on my screen. And I encourage you to take advantage of it and bring it into the classroom for your students to use. Talk about a great way for them to have more industry content on their resume. The follow-on program. This one does require you engage with a member of the IBM team so that we can set up the institution and train the faculty. But look at the areas on my screen. This is all about making sure that the high demand skills are the things that we enable our academic partners to teach, from artificial intelligence to quantum computing. And that ties back to Kendrick's point. We want to make sure all of our schools can bring this to the market, because when all of our schools bring it to the market, we can then have a roadmap to get the resources we need to have semiconductors with the best technology behind it. Skills Academy, just engage. You have my information. I'll get you to the right member of our team. We do this on a global scale. It is very much designed around faculty training, hands-on opportunities, pre-build and maintain curriculum, being able to have quizzes throughout to ensure student understanding of the material, and finalized with the instructor-led model of an exam that the students take. And then with the self-paced model, there are questions built in to ensure the student understands the content before they're able to achieve their badge of completion. This is how we've set it up. Not going to spend a lot of time on it. We talked about it before. Here's the Master's Fellowship and PhD Awards I talked about. Again, it's all on that URL we talked about at the top of the call. Final thing I'll share with you today, our IBM University guest lectures. Again, one of the most amazing ways that your faculty can bring in resources to the classroom from IBM and have the expertise engaged with your students, all at no charge. And with that, we talked about some of the HBCU metrics. I finalized our discussion today with those metrics. This didn't come out of my head. Those metrics can be found in a report written by Congress, helping us all understand how important it is that we get all of our institutions engaged in leveraging these resources. When we have a complete go-to-market model in supply chain, when we have a complete go-to-market model in semiconductor research, execution, and manufacturing and delivery into the end product, that's when we all win. So I see today we haven't utilized the resources. Again, I hope through this discussion, we change that. And in our next conversation, that those numbers are flipped and we have 100% engagement from the people on the call and those that they work with in their communities. You have my information at the bottom of the screen. I look forward to any questions, and I know we're over by 1 minute, so I will turn it back to our team.
Fantastic. Oh, there's the URL again. We got it right there. That's fantastic. We did have one final question from one of our attendees. And the question was, does IBM have resources for a course in the Internet of Things?
So on the IBM Academic Initiative site, if you go under the IBM Automation section, you will see information on the Internet of Things. And we're actually including that more in our IT management, things that might be coming later this year. So there's information out there today, and look for even more coming in the future. So thank you. That's a really good question. IBM Automation on the IBM Academic Initiative page is the way you can get started on that today.
Fantastic. And I want to thank everyone for attending today. I really appreciate you, Belinda Kennedy, of course. You did a fabulous job. Dr. Gray and Dr. Davis, thank you so much for sharing the air today. And this webinar would not be possible without Renee Lindenberg. And we really want to thank you, Renee, for all the work you do in getting these organized. So any last comments by any folks here?
I just want to say thank you to everyone who made this possible. It was a lot of great work with Renee, Kendrick, Zach, everybody, and Bob. Thank you for making this possible to have this amazing conversation, because it looks like we're going to have a lot more conversations going forward. So, and everyone Absolutely. Who's here live or listening to the replay, thank you for your time.